This podcast contains spoilers. If you wish to enjoy the podcast, please do so and listen in. Otherwise, support the official release. Did I do good? I did good. Yeah.
This episode of AetherStream is brought to you by Aetherflow Media. We would not be able to create content like this without the support of our amazing patrons. Welcome back to AetherStream with myself, Dylan Thorne, Tilp, and Croatoan. How is everybody?
Soups, guys.
Doing great.
Woohoo! Alrighty, so last time that we spoke, we left off in Yulemore right before we met Bothry. And if I recall correctly, we were downstairs speaking to, what was the one couple's name?
The Chais.
The Chais. We're speaking to the Chais, and then all of a sudden there was a commotion upstairs. So, Croa, our resident lore expert, why don't you lead us off?
So we had the opportunity to do all the investigations. Alphano brought us in as an assistant, and then he's like, all right, so while I'm painting, I need you to go investigate. And that's when you kind of get a small picture of what's going on in Yulemore. You know, this is the way the society works. You meet that poor girl who was struggling to learn what was wrong with her throat. And she's like, I really need to figure out what's going on so I can sing again. Otherwise, I'm going to get kicked out. You've already met, you know, prior to even getting in, you met that painter that got kicked out. So you know that this is a typical result of Yulemore in society, that if you don't do the skill that you came in with, you get kicked out. So she's terrified and she's crying. So you try to help her out, find out there's no cure. And then her patron, the free citizen, starts talking about how she can be ascended. He'll appeal to Lord Vothry about her ascension. And something is odd about everything that's going on in this town. As you're reporting to Alphano, you hear that scream. They tell you that someone's about to be punished. They lied, so they must be brought to justice. And everyone's like, oh, sweet. Time to watch this crime in action. Everyone runs upstairs and it's like, all right, I guess we're going to go check this out too. You know, the Chais specifically tell you, hey, you should go and see this because if you're curious about what goes on in the city, this is one of the only times you can go up there, and now's your chance to do it. And so you run up there, and this is when you meet Lord Vothry for the first time. Now, what's really interesting for me is the entire time you're going to this point, Vothry's described as like a savior, as a hero, as the great protector of the realm. And then you get up there, and it's strange. Everything about him is just, it's just pure decadence. All surrounded by the gold and the pillows and the sin eaters petting each other. You know, it's just this weird piece.
All the silky drawer robes.
Yeah, it's just, this isn't what you pictured. You know, people describe him as his greatness, and then you walk up there and you're like, you're just one of those rich guys.
I mean, that's the perfect way to describe his personality, a snooty rich kid.
Mm-hmm. Yep, literally though. And you see Kaishir, who you also, you know, with Alphano helped get into the city. Kaishir got in by using Alphano's original idea prior to finding out that he could get in by painting. He's on the floor bleeding, so Alphano rushes up to help him out and ask Lord Vothry what's going on. And Vothry's, so it's really interesting because Vothry immediately starts off by going, who are you and why are you here? I don't think I even asked for your presence. You know, he's offended immediately by you showing up. But he takes the opportunity, I guess, to teach a lesson. As a lord, he feels the need to show off why he does what he does. And he explains the reason why Kaishir's on the floor bleeding is because he's a liar. He needs to be punished. And he's like, I told him to throw himself off the balcony, but he didn't want to. So I said, cut yourself and give your flesh to the sin eaters. And he doesn't even want to do that. And he's upset. He's genuinely upset that Kaishir hasn't acquiesced to both of his demands. Any person with the sense that we have, you know, any basic sense of morality would be like, all of this is wrong and it needs to stop. You know, that's the conflict between Alphano and Vothry right now. You know, Alphano's like, this is wrong. What are you doing? And Vothry's like, no, it's not. I'm trying to handle society. And he's explaining, you know, he's trying to tell Alphano, he's like, what do you think it takes to control people in this end of the world times? You know, you have to provide a set of rules and something that people can follow. If they don't follow it, they get punished. It's simple. In his mind, you know, it's a conflict of ideals. I would imagine a majority of society would take Alphano's side in this moment. You can still see the difference of ideals. Vothry's sitting there like, you broke my law, so you get punished. How do you get punished? Throw yourself off the balcony, you know? With explaining that, he asks Alphano, why'd you get in? you know, you got into my city for a reason. What is it for? And he's like, well, I got in for painting. Vother's like, all right, paint a picture of me and I'll forgive you. And Alphino just burns him so hard. It was nice. He goes like, I don't need to paint. All you need is a mirror and you get to see the horror that I see. And Vothry takes a moment. He's staring hard for like, I don't know, 5 minutes before he realizes, wait, did I just get dissed? And then throws the biggest baby fit I've ever seen out of any character. Slamming on the ground. Like, my first impressions of this, it threw me off so bad. Because I was like, hold up. Lord Vothry, this big, powerful leader of Yulmore, is literally throwing a fit? And I sat there for a minute just staring at this. And I'm just like, I don't know what's going on here. I can't. What? Why is he literally being a baby?
One of the things I thought actually was really interesting about that scene in particular, and also our experiences in Yulmore, is a lot of it really kind of reminded me of some of the readings I've done as far as, like, you know, Roman society. And then also kind of later, I think, Renaissance or medieval Italian society. And various different ties to religion, specifically like the Catholic faith. But Vothry, when I first saw him, like, the first thing that popped into my head was Caligula. And just this figure of excess, basically intolerance, and as far as kind of thinking himself a god, what would that look like? And then, you know, all of a sudden we see Vothry, I'm like, okay, so that's what that looks like. And especially because, you know, he had the kind of Romanesque toga and everything like that. As far as, like, with Vothry and the city of Yulmore, and as far as, like, think medieval and Renaissance, like, Italy, I was thinking more like Florence, as far as you have this family, like the Medicis at the time, who are in charge of the city. And this is a city that is kind of like, the concept of it is a lot of excess, that you have the people who are important and those who serve those people. Just as far as, like, you know, everybody kind of thought, you know, the Medicis at the time were savers. And that's kind of how they saw Vothry. Even the art style in Yulmore was kind of very reminiscent of some of the styles of that era. So I really kind of liked all of the tie-ins as far as, like, in the real world, like art and culture, and how they fit that even into the personality of, you know, Vothry as character. So, I mean, all of it was really startling. Mm-hmm. I have to admit that, you know, as I'm watching this and I'm seeing, like, the little, the sin eaters off to the side, petting each other. Again, kind of thinking back to those movies with the Romans, where they always had, like, the children kind of, like, sitting off to the side of the emperor, just as decoration. And it had definitely that feeling to it. But at the same time, I'm looking at Vothry and I see this tiny thing. Like, you can't really quite tell what it is, but on his chest. And it's just, it kind of amplifies this whole idea of, this is presenting one picture, but there's something horribly wrong here. Just very disturbing beneath all of this, you know, gilded excess. I remember, like, telling one of my friends, like, he's got a face in his boob. There's a face. And he's like, I didn't see it. It's like, I think it was just a brooch. I'm like, no, I think that was a face.
No, that's a face. That's a nose on some closed eyes.
And it was
right
one of those
there.
Things, yeah. I was second guessing myself. And I even looked up like pictures online of Vothry, and it's just the way that they did a good job angling him in the pictures, the promo stuff, where you can't, you can tell if there's something there, but you're not sure what it is.
Yeah, because it looks like a fold in the clothes, but at the same time,
there's
it's still like it's the same color palette and everything. There's eyes and there's a nose. You'd see definitive facial feature and you're like, oh,
yeah,
I don't
but
like
the angle
this.
Is such a way that you're not sure. So, like I said, it's like, you know, it's this whole idea of this, you have this beautiful doubt. Like picture in front of you, but you look closer and there's something not quite right with it.
Actually, kind of bringing in some film aspects to this, the way they actually had him is kind of, I can't think of the director's name, but to empower somebody, you usually film with the camera below them looking up at them, so that way it gives them this sense of higher power, or I'm totally botching it, but, you know, giving them the sense that that is the threat and that person has the power. That's the same angle that they did there, which covers up most of it in the cutscene. Until he goes and starts throwing that tantrum and he's actually standing instead of sitting, then it kind of puts it at eye level and you can see that face there. So that's kind of how they hid that, was by showing him as, oh, I'm this powerful guy, and then, nope, I'm just a little baby.
Yeah, so that was kind of very interesting as far as just the stylization of the city and the character itself. Like, I could tell that there was a lot of thought put into it. So we go ahead and, you know, we, along with Alphino, intercede on the behalf of this person, Kaishir, to prevent him from being taken, being fed to the Sin Eaters. And as far as like the whole, you know, as far, I think there was also the line there that Vothri had as far as like, you know, the Sin Eaters live on ether, living ether.
Yep.
And
yeah
that the whole word, like when he said living, I'm like, oh crap.
Yep.
Sacrifice. So, and also kind of going back to the one little girl, as far as like the ascending, like, I don't think, as far as the ascension, I know a lot of people are like, oh, well, she pretty much made the same end that Kaishir would have. It's like, I don't think that's necessarily the case. I think ascension was...
No.
They were prepping her, but I don't think she's been ascended yet, because they did explain, like the guy said that he would have to appeal to Vothri first.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically that story kind of just cuts at that point. He was going to appeal to Vothri and then get her ascension. And she was like, you're too kind. And then he explains to you what that means. You know, Sin Eaters are the shepherds to heaven. So it's like,
Basically, we would have gotten one of those Tessa moments.
Yeah, I was thinking like, okay, so they're going to make her into a Sin Eater. They're not going to feed her to one. Yeah, she's going to become one. So.
And that's supposed to be some sort of like desired end for the people of Yulmor. It's like you do all these things to enjoy the end days, you know, in your richness and your love and splendor. And then when the time comes, you enter into that heaven, that paradise, the idea of paradise becomes what you become. And it's like, yeah, I don't know. All
little
of this sounds
suspect. So we grab Kaishir and we proceed to flee the city at a very leisurely pace.
And that was probably the most leisure escape you'll ever find.
It's more like, I believe, because Yulmor doesn't abide by violence, so it's easy to get in and out, especially if you're like a bad person, unless they try to avoid all like unnecessary conflicts. So I think because Vothri is in the moment of his panicked fit, you're able to walk out there without any problem, because he hasn't done anything to engage his forces. Because at least from what it seems, up to that point, no one's ever done what you've done before. No one's ever stood in front of Vothri and told him off, basically. And so he's still trying to process that just happened, and he's really upset.
Oh, yeah.
But he's going to throw a fit.
Yeah, no, and I've heard people like actually say, it's like, oh, wow, Vothri is not a really smart character. And like, well, I don't think the fit was a product of him not being intelligent. That's a whole other discussion really there. It would be like us, like aliens suddenly landing before us. It's like, we never have actually seen it. So if that happened, I think we would stand there for a few minutes in disbelief, like.
And just be like, I can't believe
this happened.
This happened.
Exactly. So I think it was like you said, it's like, you know, the utter shock that this actually, that somebody actually insulted me.
He even took the moment, like you can watch in the cutscene, he's just staring on blankly ahead for a good while before he's like, oh, hold up, did I just get insulted?
And then eventually the like, light comes that's on never it's happened like oh to him. There it is, finally hit it.
And then he reacts in the most petulant way, like, I'm going to tear them apart, I'm going to rip their hearts out, rah, 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 you know, like these empty vile threats, because he's never had that experience in his life before.
You're like fleeing the city at a leisurely pace, like I said, and on your way out you run across the Chais again, and you kind of tell them, give them an idea of what's going on in a very, very vague way. And
so we got
and then Mrs. Chai basically says like, oh yeah, you know, go ahead and leave, we'll cover for you, and you know, you can come back whenever you want, it's fine, I got it.
Yeah, you guys are more than welcome to come back. And yeah, you still cannot attune to the Aetherite.
But you can walk in.
So angry.
It's no problem.
Yeah, you can walk. You can waltz right in. It's just, you can attune to the Aetherite.
Yep.
So much walking.
Hey.
Quick
you know,
days.
Honestly, though, I actually appreciate that fact. And I love the fact that you have to walk back, because it takes me back to like early Final Fantasy console games, where it's not until like the last 25% of the game that you actually get any type of mode of transportation. And maybe the last 15% where you actually get an airship. So yeah, I was like, yep.
I remember that.
Oh yeah. No, it was definitely kind of fun as far as the whole walking out thing. So we leave Yulmor, we help Kaishir kind of get his freedom from the city. You know, he sees that going to Yulmore wasn't exactly all it was cracked up to be. And at the time, like, we even, like, offer him, it's like, hey, you know, it obviously did not work out for you here. And if you go back in there, you're going to die. How about that offer to go to the Crystarium? And even then, he still turns you down. And I think if I recall correctly, he says, like, you know, I don't want to necessarily go back into Yulmore. I see that it's definitely not the place for me, but I see how selfish I was. And I'm going to stay here in Gatetown, and I'm going to see what kind of life I can make here.
Yeah. He definitely does take responsibility for his actions there. I like how they have Alphano kind of look surprised for a little bit before he accepts. But Kaishir takes responsibility. He's like, I need to become more self-sufficient. He basically, I would say, if anything, it was a nice mini conclusion for Alphano.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Alphano came to Colossea looking for allies, and he's like, oh, I'm going to see what they can do. They're a seat of power. You know, they have government, they have armies, they have military. Let's see what I can do with this to fight the Sin Eaters. And I mean, by all of it, you see that he's just utterly disappointed at all. Like, there's no results. But there's one part where he's just like, I tried to help people become self-sufficient and they didn't listen to me. They were so fixated on Yulmore, there's just nothing I could do. And then this story ends with Kaishir saying, you know what, I'm going to try to take care of myself. That was nice, because it was like Alphano saw, oh, it's actually working. You know, it takes effort. It takes a lot of work, but someone is being affected by it. And so he was surprised by that. And I thought that was really cool that they added that tiny little conclusion for him. Hey, something good came out of this, despite all the absolutely not beneficial situations that resulted of by insulting the
and
Lord.
I think that was a really great moment of character development for him, especially when you think back to late in 1.0, where he started the Crystal Braves and how that turned out. And you know, that was a hard lesson for him to learn. Here it is in a smaller way. It kind of started happening again. And like you said, you know, he was very surprised when all of a sudden Kaishir is like, you know, I've learned from this. I'm going to try to be more self-sufficient. And I think for Alphano, it was like, I finally did something good and it didn't blow up in my face. So, and that was kind of like, even he said earlier, is like, I have a feeling that I'm going to regret this. But, you know, it didn't turn out the way that he had intended, but it still turned out probably for the best. So it was kind of, like I said, it was a nice win for him. It was a very small win, but it was a nice win for him. A very small win. You know what? That boy's got to take him where he can get him, because he is not very buoyant.
He's been having a lot of bad luck. It's about time something actually
happened. So we go back to the Crystarium. What happens then?
We basically make a report to the Crystal Exarch, and he's just like, so you now know what we're going through, right? Everyone reports their findings. You're like, well, from what it looks like, you know, the flood may have been stopped, but people are still suffering, and to a greater degree than it's basically the flood has stopped, but the flood is still affecting us. You know, the Exarch's like, yep, you're right. You know, this is why we have to continue to fight. This is why we have to do this. So he goes on to explain to you the concept of the Light Wardens, that over this time frame of 100 years, they've finally discovered something that might give them kind of an edge over the conflict, over this casualty, this constant sorrow that's perpetuating throughout the First. And it's these Light Wardens. He explains that the theory in question is that if we destroy a Light Warden, we'll be able to stop the Sin Eaters from fighting in force, because they follow Light Wardens like an ant colony. You know, these Light Wardens are their queens. So they're super interested in eliminating these threats, you know, these Light Wardens. There's so few of them, and they've been working hard to find out where they are to put the end to these threats. Alphano does point out that he's like, well, if we do try to go after these Light Wardens, Yulmore might not be happy about it. It's going to mess up everything he's done, and he does not like it when you mess up what he does. So they're like, we're going to have to be careful. If we go forward with these Light Wardens, when you take them out, we're going to also have to deal with Yulmore. And it's really interesting how it's like, all right, so we need to save the world, but in the process, we need to also prepare for another war as a result of trying to save the world.
So even as he says that, like, for me, I was like, oh yeah, prepare for another war. I'm like, okay, yeah, that's going to probably be down the line. However, like, everything with Shadowbringers, anything that you think is going to take you a little bit longer to get there, you're completely wrong, because it doesn't take long before the war kind of shows up at your doorstep. As we're going back to the Crystarium, and maybe I have this out of order here, you have Minnie Minfilia. She kind of senses that the Warrior of Light has returned to the Crystarium, and I think was on her way to actually go to the Crystarium to see you. And in that process, gets captured by the Ulmorans. Even though she's been on the run for years now with an old associate of ours.
Yep, you did go a little out of line.
Yeah.
We did see her before we went to the first dungeon. Okay. And then after the first dungeon, all those events take place. Okay. We did see her right after we had talked to
Alphanon. Okay, yeah, that's right. I was like trying to remember what order that happens, because I know we see the scene.
It's actually, I think it's after.
Okay.
So when we first, when finished the results of the first dungeon and what ensues after.
So yeah. Okay. So since how was it then that we kind of got pulled into the first dungeon?
So, well, there, because, you know, it does entail the whole explanation of Light Wardens. There's actually one thing I really want to talk about that, like, actually, I had to watch this cutscene several times because this was one of those things where Final Fantasy XIV has been based on political events and results of the conflicts between nations. But at this point, this brings in a whole new fight, and this brings in the fight of the universe. And so, you know, you have the option of asking the Crystal Exarchs, like, does killing the Light Wardens, how is this going to stop the Eighth Umbral Calamity? And he's like, hey, well, let me show you. And he takes his magic and he creates diagram. And so this happens in this moment. He shows you how floods work. There's so many different things to talk. I mean, I probably do a whole episode on this, so I'm going to try to keep it short. But TLDR, you know, the world was split into 14 shards. You know, there's 14 worlds total. You know, there's the source and then the 13 shards. And even though they're separate, they still have a connection to each other. There's an ethereal connection to each of the worlds. What happens is that if one of the shards attains, so if there's an element in one of the shards that takes a higher level than the other elements, and if it continues to be pushed in that specific direction, that extra energy starts to affect the source. And so we kind of got those hints while prior to Shadowbringers in Stormblood is I think it was at least starting around 4.3. The characters were referring to odd situations where the crystals didn't have any energy at all, or, you know, certain areas was the ether was thinning, and they were trying to figure out what's going on. They're like, this is weird, because I don't like the fact that these crystals don't have ether. I don't like the fact that you can't cast magic in this area. Something's wrong, you know?
Yeah.
And that's the result of the flood. And so he goes on to describe that basically all this excess ether is going to continue to pour onto the source. So at the precise moment that is happening, a calamity takes place, and the calamity cracks the source, and all that ether from that shard gets sucked in, and that's when the shard disappears. So this has happened 7 times already. And so the diagram kind of shows you each of the successive calamities. You see,
wind is the first.
Yeah, wind is first. Then it was lightning. Then it was fire, earth, water.
Water.
It was ice, water.
Then astral.
The astral light. Or astral. Yeah, the astral, which was referring to the seventh umbral calamity, which we have the opportunity to watch with the Bahamut and Dalamud.
That was a fun calamity.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, as it stands, the first is currently experiencing this excess ether in the form of the flood of light. And so all that needs to take place on the source is a calamity, and the first will get absorbed. It'll cause that crack, and then that's when they will result in what the Ascians call the Ardor and all those, and the rejoining. And so they believe that by destroying the Light Wardens, this is what will stop the flood. This will bring the ethereal balance of the planet back to its original state and avoid all destruction. And so it's interesting, because it's like at this point he's describing this to you, and then Lena runs in and she's like, help. You know, Holminster Switch is requesting reinforcements. And this is the Exarch's like, wow, this is probably really nice time to show you what a Light Warden is.
How convenient.
How convenient, yeah. It's not like we wrote this at all.
Yeah. Well, see, I was under the assumption that the Valkyrie was the Light Warden. No, I was so wrong on that one.
Yeah, they definitely mentioned that specific, you're talking about the angel in the trailer, right?
Yep, because had similarities to the one that was in the first dungeon, the one that took Tessine away from us.
Mm. Yeah, they definitely say that they're a stronger version of the Sin Eaters. But they're definitely on. Yeah, I was also under the impression that that was some sort of light warden or an explanation of such. So that's why, that's basically why you get pulled into the first dungeon, is because it's currently being attacked by a raid of Sin Eaters being led by a light warden. And the Exarch wants you to see just exactly why killing light warden will help support the issues.
I was gonna say, and this first dungeon is called Holminster Switch, and if I recall correctly, though, he explains that this is a town that lies outside of the Crystarium. It's independent from the Crystarium, but unlike Yulmore, they're not at odds with each other. They're kind of loose allies.
Yep. And this is also, so there's kind of a hint that something's not exactly, like, the Exarch didn't really tell you everything. Kind of a mysterious little important fact he left out. He said that if, you know, Lino's like, you can't kill wardens because if you end one, the ether that comprised their existence will take over the person that killed it. And you're like, wait, what? You know, this is the first time you hear about this. And without much of an explanation, the Exarch's like, we'll handle that when we get there. Let's just save the people and run in here and, you know, fight these Sin Eaters. You know, it's more or less kind of like a trial. And we also get a chance to experience the trust system. Now, if we want to talk about the trust system a little bit, because...
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Oh, like, I love it. Okay, well, I love it when it was introduced.
The story.
Mm-hmm. It does. You know, you have the option to pick is it Alphano, Alisei, Lena, or the Crystal Exarch. Now,
yep.
I'll put it in chat right now, or I'll put it in the show right now. Pick the Crystal Exarch. He can do all the roles. And this is probably the only time you get bring him into a dungeon. So please bring the Crystal Exarch, at least for one of your runs, because he's super cool. But what I really enjoy about the trust system is how, you know, they kind of encourage you to run it multiple times with the characters, because each and every single one of them react differently to what's going on in the dungeon. They have different like phrasings and stuff, and they work with, you know, with who they are and stuff like that. Their personalities kind of show through these actions, and I think it's really cool that they did that. They give these characters specific reactions. You know, they tell you that Alisei will always use the limit break, and I even tried it out. I ran with her in one dungeon, and every time limit break bar was full, she'd use it instantly, and I was just like, oh,
they weren't joking.
They weren't kidding.
No, they were not kidding at all. And on that first dungeon, I actually do recommend taking Alisei with you. This dungeon, and this is going to have a little bit of spoilers with it, has Tessaline transform. It has the angel that transformed her in it. Mm-hmm. You do get some special dialogue from Alisei, and it's just a little more heartbreaking when you see her reactions to this.
So if you want to cry more, because you'll still cry regardless, you want to cry more, make sure you bring Alisei.
Yep. Also, Tessaline does have just a little bit extra dialogue when you have Alisei with you. It's not much. It's just like a couple extra words.
Yeah. There's this one thing, and I noticed this during my first run. This is also kind of in part connected to the Amaran quest. So when you first meet Tessaline, and when she goes through her transformation, when you go into the dungeon, you notice immediately, you get to see that Sin Eater attacking the bear.
Yep.
And stabs the bear, and then the bear just gets corrupted on the spot. One thing I noticed that was so kind of like creeped me out was when in that cocoon that they come out of, if you notice, there's an overabundance of feathers, white feathers. I actually brought this up to a couple friends of mine, and it freaked them out just as much as it freaked me out. But next time you accept a res, if you get resurrected at all, I want you to watch the animation.
Like resurrection in just that dungeon, or
no,
just
actually, general, even from the beginning. Especially like white mages, you have actually, when you res, you have like a flow of like very, I would say, white feathers kind of like will fly around you.
Exactly, white feathers.
I never thought about that.
And I was like, hold up. When I saw the feathers, I saw the cocoon, and then I remembered the resurrection animation. I was like, what?
Oh, man. Yeah. That's...
So this entire time...
That really makes sense now. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I feel a little creeped out.
Yeah. Yep. I was definitely not feeling comfortable when I thought I was thinking about that. I was like, oh no, 0%.
You know, but that's actually really interesting when you also think about like the history of white magic on the source and how white magic originated with Amdapur.
And the statues they make have a certain connection.
Yep.
We don't know yet. We don't know yet what the connection is, but there is one. And they're going to explain it. They have to. At this point, with the amount of references they've made,
it's
they
one of
have
those things. It's like, yeah, it's like, okay, this point, has got to be more than a coincidence. And
oh yeah, but there's definitely some sort of connection between White Mage's Amdapur and the First. And I'm like, I'm not ready to see what that's all about because
there's already a connection between Black Mage's Mock and the Void. And the Void.
Yep.
So see, oh gosh, you know what? That it's crazy with that. It's because you also have to think about Nim, and in the fact that they have fairies. So there's a whole lot of like,
There's some strength. It's like you see similar colors, but you don't know what they're called, and you're trying to figure it out. It's not purple, but it's not, you know, like you're trying to figure it out. This is where I'm at right now with a lot of things I've seen.
Which
on the first.
Actually, kind of makes me think of something that I want to bring up later when we get to the next zone. But anyways, so one thing that actually I thought was interesting that you said a little bit back, and I'll bring it up after we finish actually talking about Holminster Switch, but it just has to do with the rejoinings. Mm-hmm. So anyways, you go through the dungeon, and if I recall correctly, you first fight the Kiribu, and then you fight Tesline, and that is utterly heartbreaking no matter which way you slice it. You get past Tesline, and you have to go through this like large courtyard where there's just multiple feather cocoons all over the place, and like as you're going through, you're like, wow. They've really, like, every person here, every living creature has been turned. If they're not dead, they've been turned. So you push through that. You finally get to the end of the dungeon, and you get to the Light Warden. And part of me, like, I sweet a little bit, honestly. I was very excited because the one thing, and I'm still hoping for this particular thing to be in its full glory, but the first thing I thought when I saw the Light Warden was, it's Anima from 10.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it wasn't exactly, but kind of looked like Anima. And it gives me hope that in future patches, we're going to see Anima, because that was one of the most badass summons ever. But anyways, so you fight the Light Warden, and man, that boss, it was a
fun fight. I'm not going to lie. Spinning mechanic, I mean, that's probably a terrible way to call it, but when when the monster's punching the ground and then tail slapping at the same time, and you basically have to do a full 360 runabout while you're still trying to keep your DPS, I thought that was fun, I'm not gonna lie. And when I mastered that, when I got really good at it, I was proud of myself.
And that was actually one of the first, like, I think to me, signs as far as what they're going to be throwing at you in this expansion, what kind of mechanics. Mm. I mean, we had already
seen
that mechanic a little bit in Gimlet Dark right before the expansion dropped. But we get a little taste of it. And for me, the mechanics throughout this expansion, what I got is how to move.
Don't stand still. Sorry, Black Mages.
Black Mages, dust. Welcome to being a White Mage.
No, we're not there yet. And when we get there,
so we defeat the Light Warden, and then we kind of get to see why the Crystal Exarch was, you know, like, no worries, we got this. We got this covered. Yeah. So you want to take it from there, Kroa?
Yes. So to add on real fast, I do encourage anyone who's interested in lore of the Sin Eaters and history of the Sin Eaters to try to run the dungeon to get the card drop. They put the lore of the Light Warden basically on the Triple Triad cards. And so they're really good to read. Kind of gives you a background of how they became what they are. And I think that's really neat. And it's also, you also notice that this Light Wardens are each named after a concept of love. And I thought that was really cool, a cool theme. You know, they got the Philia. They got Philia, and then they have, when you fight the others, there's Eros, there's Strope, I think it's described. I'm bad with my Greek. But, you know, each Light Warden is named after a concept of love. It's really cool thematically. But, yeah, so, you know, they're telling you, fall back. The Light Warden is about to release its ether. You know, the Exarch's explaining, yes, this has been a fact. Every single time I've killed a Light Warden, its ether has taken over the next person. Now I am about to show you why I summoned you here. This is why you and only you can help us. You know, it's like as he's explaining the lore of the concept, the creature's just, you know, getting ready to possess you. And you see that ball of light kind of like flow into your body and then nothing happens. You know, this is the new chapter in the history of the First. Every single time someone has killed a warden, they've become the next warden. And that was the expected result. But then you absorb this light. That's
and then
it.
You do a huzzah.
Yeah, you do a huzzah. And you cut the light from the sky. And it's just, it is so good. The animation is so good. You get to see that kind of the, what they were trying to show off in the trailer when they cut that Sin Eater in the trailer. And, yep. You know, at this moment, everyone in that area in Lakeland and Crystarium gets to experience night and darkness for the first time in 100 years. I don't think people will ever have an opportunity to really understand what that means to have that taken away from them. And then suddenly it just gets back. This has been the symbol of their hope. This has been the symbol of their reason to fight. Darkness was their savior. And all of a sudden darkness is here. And they're like, it's happening. Everything we've hoped for, everything we've prayed for, everything we've been fighting for at this point is happening now. We are in the moment of history. You know, this is a moment of change. First time they've seen stars in over 100 years. First time they've seen the moon in 100 years. You know, weather. You know, they haven't had rain. They haven't had snow. They haven't had any of that for 100 years. And then it just all comes back. And they're just like,
oh my God.
Yeah.
The sea of the endless stars.
Which actually is funny thing that you mentioned rain. Because like when I finished that dungeon and, you know, my character restored darkness and step outside of the dungeon and it was pouring buckets. And I was like, people of Lakeland, I am your savior. Welcome to crappy weather.
It rains.
You're welcome.
Welcome to Raincoats.
Behold in glory your Lord and Savior of darkness. Bow before me. I'm not going to finish the rest of that.
But I really enjoy it because, you know, they cut to the scene of the Crystarium. Everyone walks outside and they're just awestruck. And Morin, you know, he was the librarian and told you the full story. You know, he knows the legends by heart. You know, he's read the stories and he shares these with you. And he walks out and he's just like, the Warrior of Darkness is here. It's finally here.
Huh.
And Crystal Exarch comes back. He bows before you. You know, the leader of the Crystarium, the man who spent all this effort for the past 100 years, built the society that surrounds the Crystal Tower, has helped people fight the Sin Eaters for so long. He bows in front of you, your character, telling you about how he's waited so long for you to be here. And he's like, finally, you know, this is it. This is what we shed blood for. This is what we spent our lives for.
What was worth sacrificing the other Scions for? Because the thing is, you have to think about it with the Scions. Like, yeah, he didn't intend to pull them to the source without their bodies. But, you know, I think Thancred was the first one. You have to also recall the fact that even after he pulls Thancred to the First without his body, he didn't stop there. He kept on going. And he was going to keep trying until he finally got the person that he needed. And that's how desperate the situation was. It's like, you know that I'm sacrificing innocent people for this, potentially. But it's worth it.
Mm-hmm. Yep. You know the fight now. And I think what really got me in my feels, you know, despite him praising you and thanking you and proving his point, you know, this is why you and only you were needed. He apologizes. You know, he's just like, and yes, I know I didn't mean to summon you without your permission, but now you see why. And I will do my best to, you know, mend my error, to fix what I've created. But please, can you continue this fight for us? When the camera comes back, it shows you and Ardbert. It's not just you. It's you and Ardbert are in that scene when you make your affirmation to fight this war. And it's just, you know, the Exarch is still on his knees the entire time, you know, praising you for what you've done. And it's just, oh, it's such a good emotional moment. The power behind that entire cutscene of bringing back the darkness and proving the Exarch's plan. You know, he's waited so long for this to happen.
That it's actually bear fruit. Though there is,
I was going to say, one of the things that struck me about that scene was the fact that it was very similar to another important scene from an infamous movie, the last of the Lord of the Rings movies, where everybody bows before the hobbits. And it kind of reminded me a little bit of that. Yeah. And I'm like, oh, my character is a hobbit now. Yeah. Yay.
So I do want to take a side swipe here before we start calling it. So after you get done with all that and you're back at the Crystarium, first thing I noticed was, hey, go talk to the barkeeper. And then you go talk to the barkeeper and you unlock all of your role quests. I can't say class because it's roles now.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk to the barkeeper and you just sit there. Well, we haven't been this busy in years. Once the lights started flooding, people started drinking. It's like, oh my God, people are partying.
Well, it's like they have something to hope for now. They have something. It's not alcohol no longer is a means to escape the reality of what's currently going on. They can actually enjoy themselves now.
Yeah, they can see, you imagine?
Go ahead. A change in the world. They see a change in the skies and they're like, wow, all right, time to party now.
Yeah. It's like, can you imagine
all our normal lives will come back finally.
No, it was like, that was the exciting part for me, was going in there and then like people are actually rejoicing. Yeah. Some of the shops were actually closed when I tried to talk to them and get some new gear. And it's like, oh, sorry, we kind of ran out of stuff. And it's like, wait, what? How could you run out of stuff? But then, you know, given the little situation, they're kind of trying to push you to get to your thing, go to the inn, reset for the day, and then everybody's back to normal. This is what it felt like they were trying to do. You know, everybody's celebrating, and those that aren't.
I kind of really wish that the next morning they had like NPCs just kind of laying on the ground randomly somewhere going like, great party. But no, it was one of those scenes that, along with, you know, seeing everybody celebrate, like, it did really evoke that feeling of hope as well, kind of no matter how bad things are. And, you know, in that world, things are pretty bad, but they can turn around so quickly. And I love how the story evoked that feeling. And then one other thing. So before we wrap up, next time we will proceed with the next phase where we finally meet Minim and Thalia and find Thancred. But before that, so you were talking about the rejoining. One thing that kind of occurred to me is we have the Aether rejoining with the source, but that does that also include some of the physical geographical areas as well? I don't know if we've ever gotten really an answer to that. And
no, nothing confirmed yet, I would say. The idea has been passed about that features of the source have been born from the absorption of those shards. But we don't know yet. If that is a thing, there's no confirmation of. However, as an idea, I wouldn't see it too much different. I just know particularly what happens during a rejoining is that as a result of the calamity on the source, the kind of like dimensional crack that takes place in the ethereal boundaries of that realm, that hole kind of becomes sort of a vortex and absorbs all the ether of the shard that's affecting the source at the current time. And so it all gets pulled in all at once. And so, yeah, there's not that we have any example to show, but I know if anything, during the seventh Umbral Calamity, a lot of places were irreversibly warped as a result of the calamity and kind of like took different features. You know, for example, Kurthus became snowy when it never had snow. The entire region of the South Shroud, that used to be a forest as well, but now it's a swamp.
Well, you know, all of the Shroud kind of got warped in one way or another.
Yeah, there's different places the Shroud got no longer was as forested as it used to be. There's definitely a lot of places that don't have the same appearance that it did. Like the Burning Wall wasn't there in 1.0.
Nope.
That entire region in Eastern Thanalan is new. So suffice it to say, like, you know, the stance is we have no evidence of, but the theory itself might be plausible. Should we get more information on how where the ether goes. That's the main thing, is finding out once the shard gets absorbed, where does that ether go? Does it go into the planet? Does it go into Hydaelyn? Does it, you know what I mean? Like, we don't know particularly the direct result of that. And so I can't say 100%. Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
And the reason I kind of brought that up is it made me think back to Yangtze and the Azim Stops, where you have the rainbow area in Yangtze, where you have that in that the waterfall of crystal, which looks so much like the flood in an Amarang. It looks so much like that. But it's like, here's this little chunk of it back on the source. But yeah, then you had the Azim stuff where you have the, I don't know what other people call it, but I call it the giant cereal bowl. Yeah, the Dawn Throne. But I mean, still, I call it the giant cereal bowl because it looks like a big giant cereal bowl. And then you also have then the crystals that you actually manipulated in order to kind of play with the ethereal shield out there in the burn. You have all of these things. And it just part of it kind of makes me think, like, especially the Dawn Throne and some of the architecture out there is like, this doesn't seem like it doesn't seem like it fits. It seems like it came from somewhere else. And I was always bothered when you walked around the Azim steps that it doesn't seem like that there is, they don't talk about that as much. It's kind of like, oh yeah, it's just here. Okay. Mm-hmm. There's a big giant cereal bowl in the middle of the plains and we're not going to talk about that. Okay.
Yeah, no, they didn't build that. As far as I understand, the Zayla that have been living there occupy that structure, but weren't directly involved in its creation. They always attribute it to Azim. So that's all we know. And, you know, as far as deeper information goes, we know that the House of the Crooked Coin, that structure that's inside there, that's an Allegan artifact. So, I mean, there's hints that the Azim step isn't specifically everything we know it to be. But once again, it's just kind of, it's that play on legends. I've noticed specifically with the Allegan people, you know, they did in fact own the entirety of the three continents in their day and left a lot behind. And some structures remained and still retain their identity as Allegan structures. Others, however, have been taken to be the result of, you know, gods or, you know, powerful entities that people associate with these constructs and still don't realize that these are also, in fact, Allegan structures. So we don't know. Especially if you have the chance to run the Heaven on High quest, you do the Heaven on High story, and then it ends up telling you, you know, the end result of it. You're like, oh, come on. You know, you're just like, of course.
When in doubt, Allegans.
But yes. Yeah, when in doubt, Allegans, most likely. They
See, you know, and that being said, though, the structure of the Dawn Throne doesn't seem Allegan. If anything, and kind of maybe skipping ahead a little bit, it seems like a lot more like another culture that we run into eventually on the first. As far as stylistically, and that's why I'm kind of thinking like, oh, I wonder if maybe one of those sayings that, you know, during one of those calamities, you do absorb part of those other shards, which also would explain why sometimes, like, you know, when you talk to some of the NPCs around the world, as far as some of the calamities, they're like, what? So it would be kind of interesting if, you know, some of those areas came from other shards and so therefore didn't experience maybe all of the calamities. So anyways, that was just a random thought. And I was curious as far as about that. Alrighty, so it looks like our time is up for today. Next time, like I said, we will lead off as far as with meeting Minnie Manfilia and Thancred. Until then, have a great day. We hope that you join us again.
Later, guys.
May you ever find shade.
Find shade in this burning light.
Aetherstream is part of Aetherflow Media, a community-based project with a focus on Final Fantasy XIV. Aside from this podcast, we produce web content and our magazine, Aetherflow. And if you like what you see and hear, consider joining our Patreon, which you can find at patreon.com/aetherflowmedia. All funds go towards providing you with the best possible content that we can create.